We are off to a good start.
We're doing great. We couldn't figure out our time is.
Time is different for Fry, but it's not different for me. What's up with that?
I got some thick numbers. Thick.
Well, I've got the same old aerial numbers. What? Things are happening.
Hey, Patreon, though. Hello. We're just jumping right in, I think.
Sup, Popronchinis. Yeah, it's been, so long since we've recorded an episode.
84 years.
84 years. And because we're still lurking in the Pax Papatum, you know, this period of papal peace with no antipopes, we're coming back with more bizarre stories of the saints for you. And this time, we're going to be looking at saints from the medieval period, or, as I like to say, saints of medievality. You hated it the first time.
I did. I hate it.
First things first, you may hear that my voice is starting to go. I'm sorry. We need to record now or you're not going to get this episode.
This is the 24th of February.
Yeah.
We have made a grave error.
We have tried so hard to get so many recordings in and life. So the other thing is this has to be the richest area of history for the veneration and creation of saints. So as a result, we end up with a lot of weirdness, more than we could possibly hope for this kind of show. You know, this is the age of hagiography. So I have chosen a handful of stories for us to talk about, but we will definitely have to come back to medieval saints because there are so many and they are all weird. If you like this, let us know and we can do some more in-depth episodes on other saintly figures in the future. Are you ready for this, Fry?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're going to start off real strong, because I am going to tell you about Saint Drogo.
Drogo.
He is the patron saint of unattractive people.
That's not fair.
No, it's not.
That's not fair at all, considering one of the most attractive people in existence has played a man named Drogo.
Are we talking about Jason Momoa? He's not on my attraction radar, so I had to check.
He's like a soft bear man.
He is a soft bear man, and he hangs out here a lot when, you know, recently he was in, like, Mission BC, and it was weird. So this is Saint Drogo, patron saint of ugly people, and you say it's not fair now, just wait. Saint Drogo, also known as Deus, or Drugo, or Druron, was born in the early 12th century, likely around 1105, in Epinois, France. He was born into a noble family, but his mother died in childbirth during a difficult cesarean section.
Unfortunate.
Especially in 1105.
I mean, they've been doing cesarean sections quite a while before then.
Yeah, but things are not great medically at this time, so it's not good. Accounts differ on his father, but either he died before Drogo was born, or he died when Drogo was almost a teenager. But either way, the story goes that he was orphaned young and was raised by relatives instead. So now, when Drogo was about 10, about the same age that you remember Julian the Hospitaller was when he learned about the curse that he'd kill his parents one day, Drogo was told about how his mother had died, and immediately he felt an extreme sense of guilt that she had died giving birth to him. So even at such a young age, Drogo became a penitent and devoted himself to God, fasting and committing self-flagellation and performing acts of charity and service wherever he could.
Don't let 10-year-olds do that. Someone be a better parent.
Well, yeah, he didn't have parents.
The aunt and uncle. Stop.
And when he turned 18, he became the holder of his family's estate, and he just decided, I'm giving everything away, and I am going to take my first pilgrimage of penitence. And so this ends up with Drogo arriving in the town of Seaborg in France, where he took on manual labor and shepherding work for a peasant woman. Drogo quickly earned a reputation of being a hard-working shepherd, and being well-educated and always willing to tutor others in the village where he worked. But he continued to live his own life in service and penitence, donating all of his wages to the poor of Seaborg, and praying extensively.
Every single one of his wages?
Every single one. He had room and board, he didn't need anything else, it's just like...
how he feed himself.
He lives with the peasant woman, so it's, you know, skint. And it was during this time that rumors started to spread about Drogo's miraculous ability to bilocate.
What's he bilocating?
Himself! According to several witnesses, Drogo was often seen working in the fields with his sheep on Sunday during Mass, while also simultaneously attending and never missing Mass. He's in two places at once!
Yeah, okay. What? Alright.
And according to Crisis Magazine's article, Rediscovering St. Drogo of Seaborg, this gave rise to a common saying that reportedly persisted to the 20th century among the rural folk of that region, who, if charged with several onerous tasks, might protest, "I'm not St. Drogo, I can't ring the church bell for Mass and be in the procession!" That is a thing they said about him.
That's a little lame.
So, Drogo lived in Seaborg for 6 years, and during this time he would often undertake more penitent religious pilgrimages, especially to Rome, which he visited 9 times, and other holy sites across Europe.
But he would also go to church. At his regular church.
But then something happened. Somewhere along his travels, Drogo became afflicted with some sort of horrendous, awful disease that caused him to become physically deformed. And as all the sources indicate, super repulsive to look at.
Elephantitis.
Well, you're not far off because some sources I read suggest that it was some sort of extreme hernia.
What? What part of him herniated?
Leave that up to your imagination. Although, other sources call it putrescent sores on his lower body.
Okay. So it's all things that he could wear pants on and hide.
Well, if it's an extreme hernia, maybe it's, like, bulging out.
Bulging out of his pants! This poor man.
Whatever it was so bad that when he returned to Seaborg, he literally frightened the townspeople Frankenstein style. But this was their beloved bilocating Holy Drogo. So people aren't prepared to just turn on him because he's a repulsive heap of we don't know what. So they decided they were going to do something about it. What do you think they did for Drogo?
They cut it off.
They decided to build him an anchorite cell.
Oh, they just put him in you get to go into solitary, bitch.
Yeah, so he could remain in the village and pray and be cared for, but in a way that protected people from having to look at him.
But he bilocates, so he's going to be out and about anyway.
Well, apparently not anymore. He does seem to have gone with this, like, very willingly, and so they built a cell onto the church for him, and he did stay there, living without human contact, aside from those who came to his, like, tiny anchorite window to give him food and pray with him, but apparently he fasted the whole time on only barley and water and the Eucharist. And then a second miracle happened. So the church that Drogo's cell was attached to caught fire. And although the townsfolk came to try and put out the fire, there was nothing they could do because the church was already old and made out of wood and was a death trap. The next bit that I'm going to quote here, we get from an account from Jacques de Guise, who is a chronicler from the 14th century. The villagers implored, "Drogo, man of God, come out lest you die, for your cell is engulfed in flames and we cannot bring you aid." Drogo called back, "I have made a vow to God, and I will fulfill it. If it pleases the divine goodness that I should escape the flames, his will be done." Falling to his knees, Drogo remained in the conflagration and offered prayers of thanksgiving to the Almighty. And the whole church burned down around him.
Fire cannot kill a dragon.
Yes. And when the villagers mournfully came to collect the smoldering remains of their beloved, and repulsive saint, Drogo was seated there, praying quietly, completely unharmed. The church was rebuilt, as was his cell, and he lived there for the rest of his life. So it's not like, hey, maybe we wanted this man to come out. No, no, he's going back in. He died in 1186, and his remains were prepared to be sent back to his relatives in Epinois to bury him with his family. However, when they went to transport his body, another miracle happened.
That's so many.
So many. We're on three now. So the cart that was carrying his coffin continued to grow inexplicably heavier and heavier as it was pulled away from Seaborg, until at the city limits it grew so heavy that the oxen pulling the cart couldn't get it any further. So clearly this was divine intervention that his remains were to stay in Seaborg, and so they did. The villagers put down a cross where the oxen had stopped, and apparently, although not the original cross, a cross still stands today, and on Trinity Sunday there is a procession with a reliquary for St. Drogo. And I tried to find a picture of this cross for you, but what kept coming up was a military cemetery, so I was out of luck.
Oh, well.
St. Drogo was acclaimed a local saint by Vox Populi, which is acclamation of the public, although he was formally canonized by the church in 1612, and his feast day is April 16th. And his tomb became the site of miracle. The sick would now make pilgrimages to Seaborg to see the tomb of St. Drogo, and reports of people being healed were frequent through the late Middle Ages. And today, as we mentioned, St. Drogo gets to be the patron saint of coffee, broken bones, gallstones, hernias, and ugly and repulsive people. So I am going to send you some images of St. Drogo.
Let's get a look at this man.
None of them are repulsive, by the way, so...
Well, it was just his butt. He doesn't have pants on here. He's like a baby.
He does not have pants on because, you know, that's where his affliction was and they had to see it.
The patron saint of coffee. What a terrible thing. Coffee makes you poop. Don't give that to the hernia man. Jeez.
Now, I saved one for you because it's my favorite. So, here is a wonderful image of St. Drogo.
This is one of those, have you seen that? Is it BuzzFeed that did that post about thirsty Jesuses? Or thirsty Saint somebody's?
Oh yeah, it was ranking the saints from hot to not. Yeah, for sure. Definitely, because this is a very buff man with a very defined six-pack with a towel over his face.
This is just a thirst trap.
So that is St. Drogo, the patron saint of ugly people. Are you loving it?
No. Send him away.
I think you might like this next one because I think it's my favorite saint ever. So it's definitely a weird saint. And this is St. Guinefour, the miraculous greyhound.
A dog?
Yeah. Wait, what? Dogs can't be saints? Fuck you.
Why isn't Balto a saint then? Jesus Christ.
Well, here's the thing. The church says no. And I say, fuck you. You better believe that St. Guinefour is a saint because he has a 13th century cult that still kind of exists to the modern day. And they don't care what the church says. He's a saint. So the story of St. Guinefour comes from Lyon, where his master was a French knight. And one night, his master decided to go out hunting. And, like the responsible person he is, he decided he was going to leave his infant son in the care of Guinefour.
Oh yeah, you know, dogs are a great babysitter. Best babysitter. Especially really spry ones that can run real fast.
Yeah, exactly. When the knight returned, he found that his house was a scene of chaos. Furniture was overturned, including the baby's cot, and the baby was nowhere to be found.
Guinefour, you cannot eat the baby. Where is its mother?
So when Guinefour stepped up to his master, he was covered in blood. And the knight, coming to the same conclusion you have, in a fit of rage, immediately reasoned that Guinefour had killed the baby, and so he killed Guinefour where he stood. And then he heard the cries of his baby. hidden safe beneath the knight's bed. And as he approached, he nearly stepped on the dead, bloodied body of a viper.
Oh yeah, the snake, yeah. I've heard this story.
Oh yeah, it's a very famous story. Guinevere had killed the snake to protect the baby, and the knight's a dick.
And he murdered him. Oh.
He murdered the doggy. He's filled with instant remorse, and he buries Guinevere by placing him down a well and covering it with stones to set it up as a shrine for his most loyal and faithful companion that he just fucking killed. Although that wasn't good enough to absolve the knight of the foul misdeed that he'd committed, and the local legend suggests that the knight's castle ended up badly damaged and nothing would grow on his lands, and he suffered all of this divine punishment for what he'd done. But soon, the shrine became a popular pilgrimage site, particularly for those with infants. People would come to bless their infants with protection or to heal sick babies. And of course, with any holy shrine, rumors of miraculous healings became widespread. And we actually have an account of what the shrine and the practices looked like from Stephen of Bourbon's account written in 1262, or Étienne de Bourbon. Unfortunately, we have this account because Stephen of Bourbon was a Dominican inquisitor who would come and demand that the site be abolished. But we're going to read his account first. This is what they have to say about it. The local peasants, hearing of the dog's noble deed and innocent death, began to visit the place and honor the dog as a martyr in quest of help for their sicknesses and other needs. They were seduced and often cheated by the devil so that he might lead this way men into error. Women especially, with sick or poorly children, carried them to the place and went off a league to another nearby castle where an old woman could teach them a ritual for making offerings and invocations to the demons, and lead them to the right spot. When they got there, they offered salt and certain other things, hung the child's little clothes on the bramble bushes around, fixing them on the thorns. They then put the naked baby through the opening between trunks of two trees, the mother standing on one side and throwing her child 9 times to the woman on the other side.
Don't do that!
Well, exactly. While invoking the demons to adjure their fawns into the wood of Remiti, to take the sick and failing child, which they said belonged to them, and return to them their own child, big, plump, live, and healthy. Clearly he doesn't think very highly of these people.
Mm-mm.
Once this was done, the killer mothers took the baby and placed it naked.
The killer mothers!
He's not a great man. The killer mothers took the baby and placed it naked at the foot of the tree on the straws of a cradle, and lit both ends 2 candles a thumb's breadth thick, with fire they had brought with them and fastened on the trunk above. Then, while the candles were consumed, they went far enough away that they could neither hear nor see the child. In this way, the burning candles burned up and killed a number of babies, as we have heard from others in the same place. So, he hates this shrine and thinks everything bad happens there.
Yeah.
It's not for a dog, it's for a bunch of demons and they kill babies there. Ironically, Stephen of Bourbon's account has preserved the story of Guinevere in history, despite his whole intention to wipe it out. So from this, we get some of the practices of the pilgrims who are looking for miracles from St. Guinevere, not demons. But we also get his perspective as to why the Inquisitor thought that the shrine was a bad thing. And he actually demands that the remains of Guinevere be burned and the shrine destroyed, and that a decree passed that any visitors to the site would be apprehended and their property confiscated. But this did not stop people from coming.
Throw their babies back and forth?
Throwing their babies back and forth all the way up to the 1930s.
Whoa!
Yeah, the cult of St. Guinevere remained alive and well, and people continued to visit the place where the shrine had been, despite the Catholic Church's continued effort to deny Guinevere as a legitimate saint. He still gets celebrated. He has a feast day, although not a formally recognized feast day, of August 22nd, and of course, he's the unofficial patron saint of infants. And I have a picture of St. Guinevere for you. Because look at the doggo.
Oh, has he got people hands?
He's a saint, Fry. He can do whatever
That's
he wants.
A furry.
King Var was not a furry.
Look at this furry. He's got little people ears and people hands. That man has never seen a greyhound in his life. Look at how thick his neck is.
I love him. He's a beautiful... Most of the ones are just beautiful greyhounds, but I sent this one to you
the
special.
The furry. Thank you.
Next saint we're going to do as a quick tie-in to Saint Guinefor, because I want to talk briefly about Saint Roche, the patron saint of dogs and dog lovers, who Guinefor is often depicted with. So this is a pretty clever workaround for people who wanted to continue to celebrate Saint Guinefor and have depictions of him without having the church step in and try to poo-poo it, because they have Saint Roche, also known as Saint Rocum. So he comes from about 100 years after Guinefor and was born in Montpellier, where his father was the governor of the city. His birth was considered miraculous because apparently his mother had been barren, but her prayers had been answered by the Virgin Mary, and all of this was made very clear when Saint Roche was born with the mark of a red cross on his chest. You are barren, you prayed, here's your divine baby, we've branded it.
Yeah, your divine baby has a terrible birthmark.
And from a very young age, kind of like Saint Drogo, Roche was dedicated to life as an ascetic. And I do mean from such a young age, because according to the Golden Legend, apparently even as a breastfeeding infant, when his mother would fast twice a week, he would either fast with her or only take one feeding that day. Because babies somehow have some agency over that. And like Drogo, when he came to his adulthood and his parents died, he gave away all of his worldly goods and gave over the governorship of the city to his uncle. And he just, you know, he just decides, I don't want to do this. You can be the governor. I'm going to Rome and I'm going to just take care of sick people. And what a good time to take care of the sick, because the plague is here. And he served the sick so well wherever he went, the plague just disappeared.
It's his Care Bear stare from his cross brand.
Well, it's working. Everywhere that Roche would go, the plague would not follow. So he conducted miraculous healings, including healing a cardinal, who's the Cardinal of Angleria in Lombardy, by making the cross on people's foreheads because he had the birthmark. And apparently if he healed you and put a cross on your forehead, you also had a birthmark because it never went away.
Oh no, he just touched you and then it was there forever, oh boy.
But when you tend to people who have the plague, there is an intense likelihood that you're going to get the plague. Like, germ theory doesn't really exist yet. And this is exactly what happens to Roche while he was tending to victims in Piacenza. And so the town... He's healing all these people from the plague. He gets the plague. And the town decides to drive him out to a nearby forest and leave him to die. They're very grateful.
They're not at all.
But while he was languishing for death in the forest, a dog came to him and brought him food and licked his wounds, which miraculously healed. And he named this dog Guinefor.
Guinefor.
And he returned to his home city of Montpellier with the dog in tow.
What does Guinefor mean?
Guinefor is the dog's name.
No, but what does it mean?
It means dog-like.
It just means dog.
It's basically anybody named Guinefor is named after Saint Guinefor. And so, dog saint. That's what it means, dog saint. So he has his new buddy in tow who healed him, and he's feeling really good, and he goes back home. And when he got to the city, he was arrested as a spy by his own uncle. Who knows why? That's just what it is. And he died still in prison 5 years later, so he never got let out. And when his body was removed from the cell, he was recognized by his birthmark. And everyone went, oh, this man that the governor arrested as a spy was actually his nephew. That's not cool.
Whoops.
Yeah. So they gave him an honorable burial, and his dog went to live and be cared for by a noble family, and he was quickly acclaimed as a saint. He was raised to official sainthood in 1414 at the Council of Constance because plague broke out in the city, and as soon as public prayers were offered to Roche, the plague ceased immediately. So they're like, ah, we got to make this dude a saint now, don't we? And they did. And his feast day is August 16th. And aside from being the patron saint of dogs and dog lovers, he is invoked against the plague with Saint Sebastian. And this is how they get around not being able to deal with Guine Four, because in every single image of Saint Roche, he's got a Guine Four.
A Guine Four. Look at all these Guine. He really likes showing off his sexy leg.
The legs are where he has the plague wounds.
Okay, I wasn't sure, because you told me that his chest had a birthmark, and he's just like, look at my... So he's just doing that Yuzma thing.
Were you expecting this? No!
The one the dog's yelling no.
And it's also like, he's sticking his finger in it.
Most
and the dog's like, oh, stop it!
The one that's a statue, at least he's wearing some hot pants.
I love the other statue where the dog is like clearly not a greyhound. It's like a little
sheep. What is that? It's a really long-necked bulldog.
Yeah, it's just kind of squatty. It looks like somebody had to craft a dog but had never seen a dog. And they're like, squish.
That one has him going like, check out this leg wound.
He looks very proud of himself there. At least in some of the other ones. Like the first one, he just looks sad about his leg wound. The next one's kind of nonchalant.
That's some soggy ass bread.
Well, he had to give him the bread and then he licked his wounds. Guine Four is, you know, coming back to help more people and hopefully this time not get killed. And now we need a female saint to round out this first episode on weird medieval saints. She is Saint Winifred, the patron saint against unwanted advances. So she's definitely a saint for our 21st century world. So, probably not a good time for her, as you can imagine.
No.
So, Saint Winifred, or Wenfrida, was born in Wales in a city called Tegel.
In a city called Mouth Noises.
Yeah, Teglinglil. There we go.
Small Bean, read this for us.
It's now called Flintshire, so
that's
we're going to go with Flintshire.
That's so much easier.
I know. So, you know, Wales. She was born there sometime in the 7th century. Her father, Tyfed ap Fuluid, yes.
His name is Tyfed?
Tyfed, T-Y-F-I-D, A-P-F-I-L-U-D-D. Tyfed ap Fuluid was a high-level chieftain among the Welsh peoples, and her mother was called Wenlo.
Wenlo.
Wenlo. And her uncle, Bueno, is also recognized as a saint. So, from what we can tell, this, that her uncle's a saint, and her family's fairly high up, is that she came from a fairly significant Christian family. And Winifred grew up as a very pious girl, and a strong dedication to God, and a desire to become a nun. And as Father Alban Butler puts it, when the holy priest preached to the people, Wenfrida was placed at his feet, and her tender soul eagerly imbibed his heavenly doctrine, and was wonderfully affected the great truths which he delivered, or rather which God had addressed to her by his mouth. The love of the sovereign and infinite good was growing daily in her heart. Her affections were quite weaned from all the things of this world, and it was her earnest desire to consecrate her virginity by vow to God, and instead of an earthly bridegroom, to choose Jesus Christ for her spouse. Her parents readily gave their consent, shedding tears of joy and thanking God for her holy resolution. So, mom and dad are on board. They're like, great, you want to be a nun? Awesome. We don't have to pay for a dowry.
Huh?
But what have we learned about women who want to become nuns and stay a virgin for Christ?
They get put in a pot.
They always have that nasty suitor who gets mad about their religious vocation and wants them dead. And Winifred is unfortunately no exception to the pattern. And the man who wanted to marry her, a dude called Caradog, was furious when he heard that she intended to be a nun instead. So he cut off her head in front of her family.
Ooh, boy.
Because he's a shitbag. When Winifred's decapitated head hit the ground, the place where it fell miraculously became a healing spring.
Oh.
And it would become a reverend holy place where anyone who came and invoked the name of Winifred for help, they would receive her aid in matters of grace. Again, from Alban Butler's account, taken from a record of Robert Prior of Shrewsbury. In the place where the head fell, the wonderful well which is seen there sprung up, with pebble stones and large parts of the rock in the bottom stained with red streaks, and with moss growing on the sides under the water, which renders a sweet, fragrant smell. But this is not the end of Winifred's story. She didn't just get her head cut off by a douche. Winifred's uncle, the future saint, had a miraculous ability to raise the dead. This is very convenient. And through his prayers, Winifred was restored to life, although she would forever wear the mark of her martyrdom with a red ring around her neck. So she's been raised from the dead. Her uncle also prayed for retribution against the killer, who was still standing around being an arrogant dickhead. And so God smote him down dead, with the ground basically opening up and swallowing him whole. So Winifred, who's now restored to life, continued with her vocation to become a nun and spent 8 years serving at the convent in Holywell. After 8 years there, she apparently received divine inspiration to leave the convent and go on pilgrimage. So she left Holywell and ended up in Gwetheren, where she would join another convent and eventually become the abbess there. Now, historically, tracking down real information about the existence of Winifred is extremely difficult for church historians, especially because she doesn't originally appear in the Welsh records of saints, and the best records of her story don't appear until the 12th century. But there definitely are records and small pieces of evidence for an immediate cult for Saint Winifred shortly after she's thought to have died. Relics are recorded from the 12th century, and translated to Shrewsbury for a formal shrine, which existed all the way up until King Henry VIII conducted the dissolution for the monasteries and shrines in the 1540s. And when these relics arrived in Shrewsbury, that's where we start to actually get the story of her life, primarily from Robert, the Prior of Shrewsbury, who wrote the Vita of St. Winifred. The Vita also records the miracles associated with the healing well at Holywell. So, aside from just getting the aid of the decapitated St. Winifred, you could also be cured of leprosy, cured of an ulcerated breast, of lameness, of blindness, of wasting diseases, and more. And there is a shrine at this site as well that's still been preserved, and unfortunately, several others across England that are also claiming to be the St. Winifred's well. So, one of them is real. So, just like St. Drogo, St. Winifred was celebrated as a saint by Vox Populi, and she appears in the 15th century Golden Legend and Baronius's Roman Martyrology in the 16th century. And being present in the Martyrology is why she's officially recognized in the church today as a saint, despite a record of no formal canonization. They've waived things for Winifred to be like, yes, this woman's definitely a saint, but St. Guinefor, no way. And her feast day is November 3rd. So I have two pictures of St. Winifred for you. She's a pretty lady. She's not funny like the other ones. She's just a pretty lady.
Oh, she is very pretty. Look at her.
She's got her palm frond for the martyrs. If you look around her neck, she's got that red. Her head's definitely been decapitated. It still looks like it's bleeding. It's a little strange. But yeah, that is our first foray into weird saints of the medieval. If you want to hear more, listeners, please let us know, because I could talk about St. Guthlac's belt that strangled demons, the beggars of St. Martin who didn't want to be healed, and so much more. Be a good time.
Yeah.
But on that note, we want to say thank you, as always, for supporting us, and we'll see you next month. Bye.
Bye. Yeah.